Hi, everyone. This is Catherine Adams
and Elizabeth Wallace, and you're listening to Binary System Podcast number 449. And tonight, we're recapping Welcome to Night Vale number 264, Duet. And it's probably going to be a pretty quick recap because basically, while Cecil's talking, somebody else breaks into the recording and it keeps happening.
Yeah, it starts with Cecil going to the Night Vale Botanic Gardens because spring is almost here. And he arrives at the gardens and the gate is locked and it says closed to the public, but you know, you can open the lock with a lockpick, which means you're free to enter, of course, in Night Vale. And he wanders around and he finds this one area that's all these blooms, but they're blooms that haven't opened yet. So I guess a whole field of buds, which doesn't really sound as poetic. But he sees that one of them looks like it's starting to open, so he looks down at it, and then all of a sudden something starts cutting into the feed.
Yeah, it's this particular static kind of noise and everything, and it breaks in, and we hear the opening to the episode again, except with a different voice. It's Leonard Burton, which is Cecil's old boss, who's been dead for 40 years.
And the weird thing, well, the even weirder thing is that Leonard Burton knows that he's dead and he remembers dying and he knows that he's not actually on the radio, but he is still somehow broadcasting. And he remembers a man who is not short offering to give him his job back. He just has to agree to read out these carefully prepared sentences at certain times. And he starts to say no, but then the words change and he's saying, yes, absolutely. He's very happy to have his job back.
Now, throughout the entire course of the podcast, anytime basically they start to introduce a new section, that's usually where it switches over to the other person, because he's talking about the top story is that he's dead, but he also talked about Lee Marvin, JFK, the stock market, Jack Lemmon, whatever. He starts to get into the headlines. There's that room static noise again. And then Cecil's back and he's talking about the pink cocoon and how he saw a face in it and how he recognized that it was Leonard Burton.
And he doesn't think that makes any sense because he knows that Leonard Burton has been dead and he's been buried in Rattlesnake Rest Cemetery. Or is he? Because Cecil suddenly realizes he can't remember a funeral or a burial or a headstone, even though Cecil always takes his lunch in Rattlesnake Rest Cemetery and he knows all the headstones. And now he's starting to wonder why nobody really talks about Leonard Burton. And suddenly a man who is not short comes up to him and starts talking to him. And then we hear the interference noise and it's Leonard Burton again.
Yeah. And he's talking a little bit about death. And he says people want to know what death's like. He's like, it's anticlimactic. You know, he remembers his death with some pretty gory details in there, like blood and teeth on the pavement and everything. But then he's dead. And he said that life, like birth, is way more interesting, but nobody ever talks about it because nobody ever remembers it.
Yeah, and everybody's already done it before.
He also has some answers, I guess, from beyond the grave. And those answers are not much, kinda, and kinda. And I went, yeah, that makes best sense.
Yeah, and then we go back and both of them had been doing the Children's Fun Fact Science Corner. And Cecil is finishing up and saying, wow, who knew the burrowing owl had such complicated religious practices?
So I think this is the point when Cecil is trying to describe what he saw, because the man who is not short was trying to tell him, oh yeah, those are geraniums. And Cecil's like, I think I recognize one of them. And the man who's not short is like, yeah, geraniums look really similar. So even at this point, Cecil is trying to deny what he saw.
Yeah. And the man shows him out. And then that's when he's really wondering about Leonard. But he has a plan. But he's going to get into that later after the sponsor. And the sponsor starts with him talking about walking down a long hallway. And then suddenly Leonard's voice cuts in again. And he's reading these like paired words with a lot of enthusiasm, but it's obviously the pre-prepared stuff. And then it's Cecil again talking about a long corridor and a banquet table. And then Leonard again. And then Cecil again. And then Leonard again. And it just goes back and forth faster and faster.
Until at one point it switches back to Cecil and all we hear him say is weather. And then we go to the weather.
And we go to the weather. And the weather this time was, it had a very dreamlike feel to it. Something about how they did the reverb on it almost made me think that another voice was going to cut in, like Leonard has been doing on this. So that made it a really good pairing with this particular episode. But it was also very like close harmony, woman's voices, so, and a kind of pop music feel to it.
Yep, that's exactly. I wrote down soft pop. Oddly enough, who is the woman who sang for Twin Peaks that everybody knew? She got to sing the solo thing. What's that? What the hell is her name?
Rats.
She's not with us anymore.
Yeah, I know. I even have an album of Night Vale songs. Cannot remember, but you're right. It does sound a bit like that
yeah.
style.
Yeah, yeah. It was called Sheila by Worrystone. I liked it. It was nice. It was pleasant. Okay, so we come back from the weather and it's Cecil and he's talking about Leonard and he's talking about what Leonard did for his career, teaching him how to believe in himself. And also he talks about all the great things that Leonard did. Like Leonard had a lot of careers in Night Vale. He wasn't just a radio operator.
Yeah. Yeah. So what he has decided to do, and he's used all his own money for this, is that in a few weeks, I think, he and the city councilor are going to unveil the Leonard Burton Memorial Drinking Fountain.
Yep. It's got water, hot water, cold water. It's going to have soda. It's going to have hot soda. It's all great for all the thirsty people going for a run in the spring. So yep. He's very excited about it.
Mm-hmm. And I think Leonard cuts in one more time and talks about how happy he is to be back here doing his show again, mm-hmm. however that's happening. And then you kind of bounce back and forth between Leonard doing his See Ya Night Vale and Cecil doing the Good Night Night Vale, and then both of them together, Good Night. So yes, duet, also a good title for this episode.
Yes, so we got the closing proverb and all the usual closing announcements, and Kath and I were sitting there listening, we're like, okay, let's wait and see if they do a Fidelipack noise like they did in Leonard's, one of his episodes. And we waited. And then there was that rum static noise that had been used the whole episode. We're like, yay!
I love it when they include something in the end.
It was fun. Love that. So yeah, sort of a standalone episode, but I have this feeling like we're going to hear more about this later.
Yeah, and wasn't Steve Carlsberg the man who is not short, or is he the man who is not tall?
I think he's the man who is not tall.
Okay, because this was his, I guess this was his partner here, guiding Cecil out, and possibly offering the ghost of Leonard Burton a deal.
Yeah, it's funny, he said he saw a face and someone handing a microphone to him, and it wasn't until you just said that, I thought it was talking about Cecil, but I'm like, no, okay, sorry, never mind.
No. I particularly liked the bit with Leonard Burton remembering his death and remembering the accident and something like seeing his teeth scattered along the street and feeling a sense of shame that he hadn't taken better care of his teeth. And like, that just little detail like that will really get you. That tiny little element.
Oh, man. It was good. Creepy and good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's it for Night Vale. Next, we're going to talk about, what is that, episode 9 of Beastars of the final season?
That's it.
All right. I am happy to say that there is the mayor, who is a lion who has been very much like defanged and everything. He's very much a quote unquote safe lion, but he's not really safe. He's talking to Louis' father, the head of the Horns conglomerate. And one thing, he's talking about how he's irritated that the Beastar gets a higher office than him. And then he talks about the black market and about how people go there in secret. I'm like, is it secret? But he also says exactly what I said, that they say that all the meat in the black market comes from like hospitals and morgues and accidents. And he does not believe it. I'm like, neither do I.
Right. But he also says he's got the records of other sales of the black market, that sometimes herbivores would go to the black market to buy other herbivores. And look, here's a fawn that would be the exact same age as your son, and an herbivore bought him. And also, there's a fighting ring in the black market, and there's a rabbit who's doing really well, and she was also bought at the black market by an herbivore. I wonder if she would remember this fawn. And it's just like, okay, so we knew he had this information, but he used it on Rui in season 1 to like try to get him to not follow up on Haru being kidnapped by the Shishigumi. But now he's trying to get something out of Rui's father.
Right. And This is the second time that we've heard about this rabbit. We heard Lugosi's panda friend had mentioned her, and it was like a pointed reference. I'm like, oh, okay, so we're going to hear about her again. And now we hear about her again, but we've never seen her, right?
Nope, we haven't seen her in person. We have not seen any of the fights in the black market yet.
No.
We also have a meeting at the drama club, and it's the carnivores versus the herbivores. They've got a slapdash wall in between them in the room, which wouldn't stop anybody. So you can tell this is just everybody thinks this is ridiculous. But they've been told they're not allowed to participate at the, what was it, the Asteroid Festival?
Yeah.
Because they don't believe in the separation of herbivores and carnivores thing. So if you have an organization that will only perform because of that, well, they're not included. So now it's this long discussion between everybody wondering, you know, they were given two choices. Do they keep going, just have the whole group divided up into two, or do they just disband the group? And now they're all thinking they made the wrong choice. They need to go back to the committee and tell them they have to be able to participate as a group together, because that's kind of one of the whole reasons why the drama club was there. It's one of the few clubs that had herbivores and carnivores. And Bill the Tiger finally gets inspired and he says, leave the negotiations to me. And my notes here say, oh yeah, that'll work.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. It's not going to work. I know Bill has got a lot of confidence in everything, but he's not that smart. He's not that charming, honestly. So, and
he's one of the carnivores that I'm sure the herbivores warn people about, because he openly goes to the black market.
This is not going to work. Yeah.
I don't know.
So Lugosi has agreed to go to this masquerade that the Beastar wants him to go, because they want to get the Melon is the name of the counselor who's been killing people and is obviously like some type of herbivore carnivore mix. Yeah, Lugosi's just, I don't know why anybody would trust him with anything. I'm so sorry. He has no guile.
No, he doesn't. And his cover is that he's going to be like the companion, bodyguard, whatever, for a couple of the dancers. And the dancers are Cosmo and Luna, who appeared in season two. And I'm surprised that Cosmo's still working with Luna, because Luna tried to get her killed by triggering the cage to drop down so that she'd be exposed to all the carnivores in the middle of her dance. But apparently they're still working together, and Lugosi has to pretend to be a spoiled rich teenager that gets to go to the party for free, and he's like doing the whole over-enthusiastic thing as a way of acting. But I'm surprised anybody believes that.
But I forget which one of the dancers mentioned this, but they said one thing he can't do is he can't drink the red liquid. Now, it's not kinds. It's something, I don't think we've heard of this before, but I think this is what the civet cat was talking about. If I understand correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, it will make herbivores act aggressively, possibly even sexually aggressively, while at the same time, it will make carnivores kind of like forget their bloodlust. So the idea is that they take this at this party and they are all actually equal. Like the herbivores won't get eaten and the carnivores are much more mild, I suppose. Am I saying that right?
That sounds right. It's definitely not the meat lust kinds thing that was going on before. This is something new.
Got it. Now, we also hear at one point, I'm not sure why this is that at the party, everybody's wearing masks. And I think the carnivores are wearing masks that have horns put on them, but the herbivores are not allowed to take their masks off. And I don't think they explained exactly why that was the case, but maybe it's because, I don't know, maybe the herbivores are going to get too aggressive and bite somebody. I don't know. They didn't say.
No, it was just the rules. And so Lugosi, after getting scolded by one of the dancers for just looking at the drink, whatever it is, he goes to the bathroom and somebody starts talking to him about how unfair it is that the carnivores can pretend to be herbivores with the horns on their masks, but the herbivores have no way of hiding their horns. And whoever's talking has long, straight horns. And he leaves and Lugosi smells what's coming up out of the urinal. Oh my God, the show is so weird.
weird. So weird. Oh, God. It took me a minute to realize what it was that he smelled, but it's actually kind of brilliant. He chases the figure down, who's very graceful and everything. Even the Beastar had pointed out several people in the party that he thought might be Melon, and one of the things was a curved spine like a cat. And I thought about it. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. Like, you think about a horse, they don't really have that flexible of a spine, but a cat definitely does. So, so he watches him head up this, like, you know, side of the wall and everything. And he's like so entranced by how graceful they are. Like, what, she just loves herbivores.
Oh my God. He was almost drooling when he was first looking at Cosmo, the dancer, about how, like, you know, great, you know, herbivores are so beautiful. I'm like, all right, settle down, Legoshi.
Yeah. So he tracks who he thinks is Melon. Spoilers, it is, to like this sort of like video booth and everything, like a control room and everything. And he contacts the Beastar and tells him where he is. And the Beastar goes to abandon him. But what we find out is, like, the Beastar gets distracted by a bunch of the people at the party. So nobody's coming to save Legoshi. And unfortunately, Melon gets the drop on him, of course, because it's Legoshi, and has a knife to his throat. And he wants to know how Legoshi recognized him. Legoshi could smell the meat in his urine, which would not be the case if it was an actual herbivore. I went, okay, that does actually make sense.
Yeah, that does. It's just like, but because of course he was smelling it coming out of a urinal. And like,
of course he was.
I don't know how many other animes out there do this sort of thing, but it's just like, they don't shy away from anything that would be like, oh no, that's too much. Like, nope, they're going right for it.
Oh yeah, they are. So Legoshi and Melon have a little talk, and Melon finally takes his mask off and we get to see what he looks like. And it's this big reveal. I don't know. Somehow I thought maybe it would be somebody we'd already met. The lead up to it had been so like, we get to see his face. And I was expecting a twist. No, it's somebody we've never seen before.
It's very unsettling. And they went a different direction than the original manga did. The original manga, it's a much more, I don't know, the smile is sharper, like big and exaggerated sort of thing. And when you look at it in the anime, you could definitely tell there's something very off. I mean, it's not just that he has sharp teeth, but they've done a very good job of combining an herbivore and a cat face and making it look kind of wrong. I mean, a couple times when you saw in profile, you can see his smile does curl up a lot wider every once in a while when he's talking. And his movements are all kind of like flamboyant and everything.
Yes.
And it's just, you know, all very weird.
He's clearly unhinged. You hear him laughing a few times. You're like, oh yeah, he's not sane. But he starts talking about Legoshi. He knows that Legoshi is also mixed blood. But he asks about Legoshi's mother, and this is where we found out what happened to her. Legoshi's mother killed herself when he was 12 years old.
Yeah, and he had, Melon had thought that maybe he was the product of a mix, but it was actually his mother was the product of a mix, and his mother couldn't handle it. They don't go into detail. Legoshi doesn't say why she committed suicide, but he doesn't really argue with Melon about the idea that she did it because she was a mix.
Yeah. And Melon talks a lot about how mixes are freaks of nature. Like, Legoshi tries to argue with him, and I don't know, Melon just sort of shouts him down. I mean, he just believes, he says he has no friends and no family because he's a mix, so there is no one else out there like him. So I don't know what the show is saying about that at this point. Is that, like, are they trying to say, oh, he's so wrong, you know, he should have a family of some sort? Or are they like, yeah, he is a freak of nature because there will not be anybody out there exactly like him? And I'm like, interesting.
Yeah, he did say that society talks about how progressive it is, I suppose, that you've got animals from different species coming together as a couple, but nobody feels the same way about the product of those. And I don't know if they're saying that the product is bad or just that society doesn't seem to really want to care about helping these children that are growing up not really part of one or the other. They're just kind of like, ew, and then leave them to their own devices.
Yeah, and I like what he said at one point, because when he said that they were freaks of nature, and Legoshi jumps in and is like, I don't think you're freaks of nature. I think you're amazing, all this. And he says something like, God, what a boring, trite thing to say. And it sort of reminded me of, there's a lot of virtue signaling that goes on every once in a while that's just in our current political environment. that is not helpful, and it's not, I don't know, it's maybe not realistic, or I don't know, when people are just like, oh, you know, I don't care that you have different opinions from me. I mean, I think we can all come together, and I respect your opinions even if I don't agree with you. And I'm just like, I don't know. Oh, there's a lot of people who will say that, and I'm like, I don't know that that's true. You know, I think when the chips are down, I don't know. I just remember seeing some arguments where people were saying, it's like, oh, no, I don't agree with you, but it doesn't mean I don't like you or whatever. And they're like, oh, so you don't agree with anything that I stand for, and you'd be fine with seeing me, you know, dead in a ditch, but at the same time, you think I'm a good person or whatever. I don't know what I'm saying, but I just somehow that really resonated with me when he said that.
Yeah, well, there's also the idea when people say, oh, well, no one should be racist. I don't even see color. I'm like, You don't see the fact that people probably have different things that they have to deal with specifically because of who they are and how they look. And if you ignore all that, then you feel comfortable with being able to say, well, if they don't succeed, then they just weren't trying hard enough. I'm like, You have to acknowledge reality.
Yeah, you do. You do. Also, I mean, the whole thing, I don't see color. I think we should recognize different races, different ethnicities and everything. That makes things interesting. I mean, we don't need to be racist about it, but I'm saying we don't want everything to be homogenous either. We don't want, I mean, that's what led to I think Dad was telling us, what was it, in the late 50s, early 60s, where they're basically telling African-Americans, it's like, oh, you'll be just fine as long as you dress like us and talk like us and do your hair like us. And African-Americans were like, no, because black is beautiful, you know, fuck off. And that's where a lot of the very flamboyant clothing and the hair came from, because it's like, you should see the differences because it's cool, you know, but I don't know.
Yeah, I know. And of course, in the news, there's been the announcement that the Arlington Cemetery has removed pages from its website talking about the burial locations of people who, you know, soldiers who died serving their country, who are African-American or Hispanic or women or whatever like that. And I know there are all these people are saying, oh, we should just stop treating everybody as like by their races because everybody's an equal soldier. I'm like, well, a lot of women and Hispanic and African-Americans had to work a lot fucking harder to get where they were simply because of how the system was set against them. And maybe we should recognize that. I don't know.
It's just, ugh. Okay. All right. That's all of our political discussion.
All
I started this. I'll stop it. I'm sorry. Yes. No politics. It's fine. Anyway, so they continue talking. And of course, Melon knows about the little device in Lugosi's ear that lets him talk to the Beastar. So he rips it out to talk to the Beastar directly.
Yeah. And the upshot is that Yaya gets to watch as Melon stabs Lugosi and then throws him off the catwalk.
Yeah. To the point where, like, before he fell off the catwalk, there were some people having a drink and these little drops of red fell. It was Lugosi's blood dripping down from the catwalk right before he hit the floor. Yeah. So he wasn't moving at the end. I can't imagine that they'd kill him, but he did look kind of dead.
Yeah, well, they were definitely telegraphing that because his eyes were open and there was a spreading pool of blood underneath him. Mm-hmm. So yeah, violent.
And that's where the episode ended, of course, because of course it did. Mm-hmm. He's not dead. There's no way he's dead.
No, come on. He's the heart of the show at the very least.
He is. No sign of Haru at all this episode, actually.
Not one bit.
Mm, okay. Or Juno. Oh, no, we did see Juno in the drama club meeting, though, right? She was there briefly, so.
Yeah, Juno was still in the drama club. Who was the very flamboyant Ram, I think, who was...
Oh, I can't remember his name. He was the little bit of a womanizer. You know?
Yeah. He left the club, I think. I don't think he liked either choices about disbanding or just working as two separate groups. He just decided, I'm not interested anymore. Goodbye.
Yeah, we did have, I guess, the aardvark or anteater or whatever, the one who had gotten his arm ripped off, and he made a big old speech about how it's not good if we can't touch each other. And I'm just like, again, the subtext is text, so, you know, it's just, I don't know.
It was very moving, yes.
It was very moving.
At the same time, it's been done before.
Yes, it has. Also, I will never forget how he told the guy who ripped his arm off. It's like, I was hurting, but you hurt more. And I'm like, no, he didn't. You had your arm ripped off. What are you doing? All right, so that's it for Beastars. So we will jump in to Star Trek Lower Decks.
So season 3, episode 3 was the one where everybody was having to clear away these mind-controlling orbs on this planet, and it was the Lower Decks from the Cerritos versus the Lower Decks from another ship, whatever, and they were having to do a disassembly thing on the ship while the Cerritos crew was trying to clean up all of these orbs and everything, and it ends with all of them in a cave, like agreeing that, oh, wow, you guys were all misunderstood. We all work better together. Because, you know, each of them thought that I was waiting for the entire episode for it to be a big reveal that this kumbaya moment was another hallucination from these mind controlling things. But that didn't happen.
Nope. It was exactly what it said on the tin.
Yep, exactly what it was. So, yeah. I don't know if there was, what was the B story on that one?
I don't remember. Yeah. It's been a long time since I watched them. I need to actually go back and rewatch, especially when I know that you're going to be talking about them on the podcast. I really should watch them.
Well, so that one was fun. But season 3, episode 4 was hilarious because, okay, so you had all of the engineers like have been working overtime to fix the damage from the last time that the captain was possessed by some ancient artifact and turned some of the corridors into stone, whatever, but... And it ends up with the captain getting even more freaked out and stressed because the engineers just want to work and they're not relaxing at this spa that they've created. And at one point, you've got the captain's being dragged off screen and she's going, engineers, all of them, they're nothing but goddamn Geordi LaForges. Another element to the whole, oh, here you go, nerds.
I love it when they give something to the nerds.
So Rutherford's with the engineers, but Mariner, Boimler, and Tendi have overheard the Lower Decks Delta crew talking about how they're going to reprogram this lottery that's come up for rooms that are on one of the upper decks so that they could actually have some privacy and sleep in a more comfortable place than this, you know, barracks that they're in most of the time. So Tendi and Boimler and Mariner decide to take a shortcut through the guts of the ship to try to get to the computer console first. And they go through a section where, like, Tendi isn't affected by it, but it's this sort of, like, sump area that has, you know, plants to generate oxygen, whatever, and also a lot of hallucinogens. Boimler and Mariner get stoned off their asses. They are hallucinating all over the place. They're just, like, their arms are morphing, and Boimler's head is turned into spikes, whatever, and Tendi's trying to get them to, like, move on because the oxygen content is getting kind of critical, and Boimler, at one point, he says, okay, you guys stay here and feed the rabbits. I'm going to find a way through this maze. And just, I had to stop and rewind it 3 times. That one bit was so damn funny.
God, Jack Quaid is just, I love him so much. And I'm glad his movie career is taking off, by the way.
Yeah.
He seems to be doing really well. Did you hear about the one called Novocaine?
I have not read the review. I saw that Hugh posted a review of it on Pixelated Geek, so I have to read that. But I was just like, Oh, he's a movie star now. That's so fantastic.
Oh, do you know what the premise of that is?
That he doesn't feel any pain whatsoever. So now he's like an action star trying to rescue his girlfriend, I think.
Apparently, like, Hugh says that usually a lot of, like, the body horror stuff doesn't bother him. He said some of the stuff they were doing in this movie was making him cringe in his chair.
Whoa.
He said it's really super, super intense what they do to a guy who can't feel pain. You're like, oh, I don't know if I can watch that one.
Did you ever watch the Red Letter Media episode I sent to you? It was the Halloween one that Jack Quaid was in.
No, I need to. I know
it's
I do.
Really funny because, I mean, when he guest starred on the show before, it was right before he was going to go start filming Oppenheimer because he had a big part in that. And they had this running gag where every time there was a break between the movies that they watched, one of them would get Jack Quaid alone and like talk to him about, can you talk to Nolan and show him this script, whatever? And it's just, and he actually got, he has such a sport. He was actually did a callback on the Halloween episode
where
Mike asked him, oh, Oppenheimer, how did that do? And Jack's like, great. Like, well, it was no monkey top hat goes west, but so yeah, that's
so
fun. Definitely fun.
Nice.
But yeah, I mean, this, the whole thing, it was almost the same thing at the end of this episode where the two Lower Decks people are like in the same area waiting for a security door to open and actually bonding about the fact that it's so fun to be able to sit with each other and talk. And really the only difference is that they have different sleep schedules on board the ship. So really they could all be friends. And then the door opens and the Delta crew kicks him in the face and runs for it and managed to get to the console instead. Except that Boimler figures out another shortcut and they get to the console and found out, oh no, it's not 4 rooms on the first deck. It's 1 extra room, I think, on deck 4. And they don't want to split up. So they decide they're just going to stick together. you know, Lower Decks friends forever. And then you go to the bar with everybody partying and all of them like, oh, they got the one room. And so they just set up four beds in the room. Why didn't we think of that? And I was like, I thought of that. I was thinking of that. I'm like, man, God, would that be against the rules? Couldn't you all just like camp out in one room and not have to sleep in the barracks?
No, it just, it's so typical of them. It really is. Like, we just didn't think of it. I don't know. So.
But yeah, just God. For that maze, that line. Oh my God, that was so funny.
Oh, I love this show so much. I wish somebody would pick it up like they picked up Futurama, you know?
Right.
I mean, they could still do good things. Come on.
There's still that option. I mean, it is Star Trek, so it's that can't let anything die that's really good, I would hope.
Yes. Oh, fingers crossed. Jeez.
And the only other thing about that episode was that as they're sneaking through the ship, they go through the holodecks where T'Ana and the security guard that she's the head of security who she's sleeping with, and they're doing like a 1920s gangster shoot 'em up of a bank, whatever. But he's starting to get upset because she never wants to talk about his feelings. And at one point, he's like, what are we doing? And she's like, what we usually do, we'll, you know, kill all these feds and then we'll do the nasty on the counter and make the hostages watch. I'm like, I love Dr. T'Ana. Oh my
God. She's so cool. Oh, but that will wrap us up for the week. So make sure to check out pixelatedgeek.com for all the book reviews, the movie reviews, the comic book reviews, the photo galleries. WonderCon is almost here.
Yep,
so
yep.
We've got a little less than 2 weeks as of time of this recording. So now, very excited.
Which book did you decide to go with for your reading material for the trip up to LA?
It was the one that you recommended to me, which name I can't remember, but it's like on my, I've got it like queued up in my Kindle list.
Yep. The book that wouldn't burn. It's interesting. Nice. And it's got one of my favorite settings for a fantasy novel. So I think you'll like it.
Nice. Yeah, it's because 2 years ago, Jada wasn't able to make it. So at the last minute, I had to get a hotel room, a very, you know, I'm not seedy, but it's just a low frills motel room and everything. And I made myself a nice bath and I sat in there to like drink a beer and read a book. And I was reading Ursula Vernon's The Hollow Places. And there is this scene, and it's not even that far into the book. And it is just absolutely one of the most disturbing images I have seen in a book in probably like ever. And that colors my entire memory of staying there. So I know I'm not going to get something necessarily that disturbing, but I was like, I need to read a good book when I'm there. That's kind of the rule.
Awesome. I love things that color your recollections of trips.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, having books and being able to go back to it and be like, oh yeah, I remember what I was doing when I was reading this book. That was fun.
You were reading House of Leaves when you were at my place that one time, weren't you?
Oh yes. Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Well, the first, I mean, I finished reading it here in North Carolina, but the first time I read that was at your place. And it's just like, and that's kind of the thing that comes to mind when I reread it. Cause House of Leaves is awesome.
Oh my God. It's like, they just had, I think it's the 20th anniversary of when it came out. I'm 20 years.
God.
Oh, my bones just turned to dust.
Jeez.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Okay. And on that note.
Yes. Anyway, all that and more, pixelatedgeek.com. So no Night Vale next week, but we have some more Beastars we got to watch.
We do. Yes. 3 more episodes.
Yep. And whatever else distracts us. So one way or the other, we will talk to everybody in 1 week.
Talk to y'all later.
Elizabeth Wallace. Try that again. Lugosi is going to that masquerade.
Oh, hold on a second. First we have the meeting of the drama club, don't we?
Oh, we do. We do. Sorry. Back that up. Okay. Hang on. I had something I was going with that. Oh, sorry.
And Boimore and Mariner get stormed. Hang on a second. How much time do we have left?
We got 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Okay.
Yeah, that's good.
Can you talk to, what was the director's name?
Nolan. And I made myself a nice bath that one night that I was there, and I was sitting there reading Ursula Ambulance. I knew it. I was just like waiting. I was like, maybe they're gone? No. They're still here. Come on, we've only got 4 minutes.
Okay. Come on now. Be funny if we had a fan that actually figured out where you lived and worked as a police officer so they could drive around here and like, it's me.
That's me.